You are listening to Labor Express, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I'm your host, Dorian Brewer, and I'm filling in for Jerry Mead Lucero, and this is the Monday, January 3rd, 2011 edition of Labor Express. As we start a new year here in 2011, on today's show, we will look back at an inspiring episode in American labor history, the Seattle General Strike of 1919. We're going to see what lessons this important event holds for us today and looking forward. We will bring you speakers and music from a 2009 90th anniversary event in Seattle, celebrating the historic General Strike. First up is an excerpt of the documentary Witness to the Revolution, courtesy of Stourwater Pictures, that includes a summary of the 1919 Seattle Workers' General Strike.
With the armistice, the war in Europe was over, but at home there was still no peace. In the winter of 1919, unemployment and a cut in wages caused the Seattle shipyard workers to strike. They called on all workers to do the same, to create a general strike, a massive stop-work movement that would shut the city down. It was an unprecedented move, forbidden by every union charter and condemned by the American Federation of Labor. As the deadline for the strike drew near, panic sent people into the stores to hoard food and supplies. The fear that Seattle would erupt with riots induced some citizens to be deputized. The National Guard was mobilized, ready to quell the impending revolution. And across the country, editorials warned, "The Bolshevik beast has come out into the open, and it is only a step from Seattle to Petrograd." From her office in the Seattle Union Record, the city's only labor-owned paper, Anna Louise Strong issued her own call to arms.
"We are undertaking the most tremendous move ever made by labor in this country. A move that will lead no one knows where. We do not need hysteria. We do not need fear. We need the iron march of labor, for labor will feed the people, care for the babies and the sick, and preserve order. Not the withdrawal of labor power, but the power of the workers to manage will win this strike."
Her editorial, I mean, it seems to me, sums up the spirit of that strike. They didn't know what they were doing, is the way I would interpret this, or where they were going. But it sounds ominous. It's got a kind of romantic touch to it, and it captivates people even now. I mean, their eyes get big when they think about that editorial.
It was the first general strike in U.S. history. The wealthy, fearing revolution, fled to hotels in Portland. The middle class, fearing violence, stayed locked in their homes. Seattle functioned as a worker-run city, inspiring Strong to write,
"If by revolution is meant violent, forcible taking of property, killing of men, surely none of our workers dreamed of such action. But if you mean that a great change is coming over the face of the earth, which will transform our methods of carrying out industry, then we do believe in such a great change, and our general strike was one step towards it."
After only 3 days, the strike collapsed. But for Anna Louise Strong, it was not the end, but the beginning.
Next up is James Gregory, the chair of the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies at Washington University in Washington State, who gave an introduction to the 1919 Seattle Workers' General Strike.
So let me tell you a little story. At 10 a.m. the morning of February 6th, which fell on a Thursday that year, a sharp whistle sounded in downtown Seattle. It was the signal to stop work. On job sites throughout the city, men and women put aside their work, grabbed their coats and hats, and headed for the street. More than 100 unions had voted to stop work at that hour, and more than 60,000 workers responded. Among them were teamsters and streetcar men, building trades workers, pressmen, longshore workers. The waitress union joined the strike, shutting down all of the city's restaurants. Hotel maids and lady barbers also joined. It was the greatest display of working class unity in this city's history, and the first declared general strike in American history. It electrified the nation and the world. Journalists had flooded into the city, and now the telegraph lines hummed with the news that the strike was actually underway. This was a solidarity strike. The unions of the Central Labor Council, meeting in the original Labor Temple over on Union Street near 6th, had agreed to strike in support of shipyard unions that had been on strike already for 2 weeks. They were fighting for a wage increase that the federal government had promised during the war and then reneged on when the war ended. But the feds and the metal trades unions had shut down the shipyards, and now the unions of the city joined together to shut down the entire city. The stakes were high. This is just months after the end of World War I, and a little more than a year after the Russian Revolution. Some of the strikers are wobblies and revolutionary socialists, hoping that this is the start of a revolutionary sequence. Most of the strikers have different goals. They have watched during the war as profiteers get richer and richer while wages are mostly frozen. They think it's labor's turn, not just to raise wages, but to raise dignity and authority. They're also worried that the shipyard strike is a harbinger of an open shop movement, a plan to derail and stop the progress of organized labor. The strike is impressive at first and surprising. Authorities had been expecting violence. The mayor asks for federal troops, and 1,500 soldiers from Fort Lewis are dispatched to the city, taking up positions in the National Guard armories. Mayor Ole Hansen had worried about violence, and so he deputized more than 2,000 citizens, conservatives, as special deputies who are armed and ready to back up the police department in case of violence. Machine gun emplacements are seen on the streets of Seattle. But the Central Labor Council is on top of things. There's no violence at all. Indeed, what everyone notices is how quiet the city is. Few crowds gather. The General Strike Committee has organized 300 war veterans into a force called the Labor Guardians, and they move through the streets urging people to disperse, not to do anything to provoke the police. Meanwhile, the labor movement is providing essential services. Food kitchens are operating in many of the labor halls, feeding 20 to 30,000 citizens, strikers during the day. Teamsters are delivering supplies to hospitals, delivering milk to places where children, families with children can get it. But the strike is also failing. By day two, certainly by day three, it's clear that the hope that this gesture of power and solidarity will help the shipyard workers is not to be. The feds dig in their heels, and local authorities, backed up by the major newspapers, are becoming more and more hysterical. The expression of workers' solidarity has scared many people, and conservatives now have the upper hand. On Saturday, several unions tell their members to go back to work. Others soon follow. The Central Labor Council officially calls off the strike on Monday, February 11. It has lasted 6 days. The strike failed, but it did not fail. It served as a model for other big strikes that year, huge strikes in the steel and coal industries, and another general strike in Winnipeg. It served as a model for the big strikes of the 1930s, including the general strike of 1934 in San Francisco and another in Minneapolis. It was a model because it demonstrated two things: that workers would indeed come together in impressive displays of solidarity, and secondly, that they could do so peacefully. That big strikes could be powerful without turning into massively violent confrontations. General strikes have come to be rare in the United States, and we should ask ourselves why. They're not rare everywhere. This is last week. This is Paris. Last week, the Union Federations of France declared a general strike, a one-day general strike, 2.5 million people in the streets, transit, work disrupted and stopped. This is one of my favorite little slides. This is the airport in Paris. Planes not going anywhere, trains not going anywhere, subway not going anywhere, people not going anywhere, except into the streets, where they were protesting the government's inaction in the face of this great recession that we are in. Inaction on the one hand, and plans to cut jobs, cut services, cut the social safety net, cut education. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound familiar? And what do we do while the plans to cut social services and to throw tens of thousands of public employees out of work are being hatched and worked through in our state? Well, we could talk about that.
Welcome back. This again is Dorian Brewer, today's host for the Labor Express radio program, filling in for the esteemed Jerry Mead Lucero. And today's show is all about remembering one of the most profound events in U.S. labor history, the 1919 Seattle Workers' General Strike. Now, we are generally aware of what happened that led to the strike and the strike itself. Now we will hear from Howard Klimdorf, a professor of sociology, University of Michigan, who will analyze the 1919 Seattle Workers' General Strike in more detail, the role of the IWW in the strike, and the strike's legacy and lessons for today and beyond.
Howard Klimdorf is a professor of sociology and chair of the sociology department at the University of Michigan. He's the author of a number of important books about labor history, including Reds or Rackets, a study of the two longshore unions, West Coast and East Coast, and their different cultures. His other famous book is Battling for American Labor, Wobblies, Craft Workers, and the Making of the Union Movement. And he's going to talk to us today about the legacy of solidarity that comes out of the IWW and the general strike and how it lives on in the labor movement. Please welcome Howard Klimdorf.
Case: the Seattle general strike was by far the biggest up to that point in American history. But its significance is not just in its size alone, but in its radical vision. Some of the strikers compared their efforts to those of the Bolsheviks who had just overthrown the Russian government. Mayor Ole Hansen, I don't usually get that reaction when I say that. Mayor Ole Hansen of Seattle, as you saw, took credit indeed for suppressing a revolution in Seattle and then later ran for the candidacy of the Republican Party on that plank alone. The strike itself fueled the state's reputation as a stronghold of radicalism and of labor militancy more generally. Capturing this sentiment years later, a member of Franklin Roosevelt's administration complained in the 1930s that his task was made more complicated because in addition to overseeing 47 states in the country, he had to worry about the Soviet of Washington. In my comments, I would like to begin by briefly identifying what I think are some of the immediate causes of the general strike, and then suggest that this walkout, while exceptional in many respects, was really part of the mainstream of the American labor movement. Specifically, that the general strike displayed a pattern of organization that can be described as a kind of syndicalism, a term that I will discuss momentarily. 90 years ago, almost to this day, residents of Seattle witnessed the largest citywide strike in North America when 60,000 workers failed to report to work. Historian Robert Friedheim opens his book on the Seattle general strike with the following description. At 10 o'clock in the morning on February 6, 1919, the city of Seattle was ominously quiet. Buses and trolleys remained in their barns. No smoke poured from the chimneys of factories, workshops, or foundries in the ordinarily bustling industrial portions of the city and its waterfront. On that Thursday morning, even the public schools of the Northwest Queen City were closed. The downtown streets were virtually deserted. Only a few people moved quietly past closed stores and shops. In fear of hardship and violence, Seattle's consumers had long since emptied the store shelves of food and fuel, as well as rifles and pistols. Wealthier families had left the city for a haven in Portland. The first major general strike in American city, in American history, had begun. I want to begin by asking why this time and why this place? Why the strike took place in Seattle in 1919? There are at least three factors that contributed significantly to the strike at that point in time. The first, as you've already heard a bit about, was the immediate post-war context. The demands of wartime production led to booming economies in war-related industries like munitions and shipbuilding in Seattle and elsewhere. During the war, there were rising costs of housing and food costs in conjunction with a no-strike pledge from the labor movement, which in effect depressed workers' living standards throughout the period of the war. When the armistice was signed, work orders ceased and unemployment began rising. Against this context, employers opened an open shop offensive against labor, trying to roll back the demands and gains that unions had won prior to the war. All of these came together to produce a dramatic spike in labor activity, labor insurgency, and strikes in particular. In 1918, more than 1 million American workers went out on strike, representing something like 6% of the national labor force. That was a dramatic figure, but a year later, it had quadrupled. More than 4 million American workers went out on strike in 1 year alone, representing an incredible 22% of the American workforce, one out of every four workers going on strike in a single year. The Seattle general strike was clearly an expression of this spike in labor militancy. A second important factor that contributed to the Seattle general strike was the particular nature of the Seattle labor movement itself. In the Pacific Northwest, as you know, was a stronghold of the industrial workers of the world, or the Wobblies, who had large followings had and still have in the lumber, mining, and shipping industries, and obviously beyond that today. The IWW was founded in 1905 specifically as a radical alternative to the then-dominant American Federation of Labor. The IWW saw itself as a revolutionary union, and its leader, Big Bill Haywood, famously called for abolishing the wage system. In sharp contrast, the AFL advocated a policy that's come to be known as pure and simple unionism, which was to make small incremental demands for better hours, wages, and conditions for their currently employed members. The leader of the AFL, Sam Gompers, was famous for always endorsing and supporting capitalism, which he described as the best system ever developed. Ooh. I'll come back and talk again. This is... For a national organization like the AFL, known for its conservatism, the Seattle AFL was clearly out of step. In 1919, for example, at the AFL's national convention, Sam Gompers was reelected overwhelmingly with only one vote cast against him, and that was cast by the delegate from the Seattle AFL. The The Seattle AFL also broke with its national organization in endorsing industrial forms of organization against the wishes of the AFL, which was closely wedded to notions of craft organization that had to be organized along relatively narrow occupational lines. Seattle was also the only city in the country to boast a daily union-supported newspaper, the Seattle Union Record at the time, which drew support not only from radicals in the city, but also the mainstream of the AFL. And indeed, when the Wobblies themselves came under attack locally, the AFL leadership came to their defense, something that would have been unthinkable in almost any other city in the country, given the animosity and tension between the two organizations. As a consequence of this, the Seattle labor movement was unusually highly unified, and it gave a central and strong voice to radicals who were otherwise on the periphery of the AFL. The third and final factor that contributed to the general strike was, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution, which had happened 16 months earlier. Labor organizations around the world were intrigued by the first self-professed workers' government. Long before Stalin, the fledgling Soviet Union offered tremendous hope for workers around the world. Even AFL leaders in the United States sent congratulatory telegrams addressed to Comrade Lenin. The Seattle AFL, as usual, went farther. They sent a delegation to the Soviet Union, both to investigate the new conditions and to offer their assistance. In sum, these three developments, the post-war strike wave, the unified and radical character of the Seattle labor movement, and the international influence of the Bolshevik Revolution, were so much dry tinder. All they needed was a spark, which appeared in the form of a wage dispute in the city's shipyards, and that led to the conflagration that became the general strike. The general strike, then, was a product of favorable conditions at a particular point in time. But, and this is the point I want to turn to now, it was also much more than that. Specifically, the general strike tapped into enduring traditions that have defined the American labor movement, traditions that can best be understood as a kind of pragmatic or practical syndicalism, which I'll describe momentarily. What do I mean by syndicalism? It's a theory of trade unionism that is most closely identified with some of the most radical labor movements in Europe during the first quarter of the 20th century, particularly the French, the Italian, the Spanish labor movements, as well as labor movements in Latin America, where self-described syndicalists were a vocal but minority presence in labor. In the European context, syndicalism has three defining features. First, syndicalists are opposed to the state or the government as an institution, and they are opposed to politics as an arena of action. Now, let me be clear, this is not the traditional opposition to big government that we sometimes hear today from conservative forces. On the contrast, syndicalists drew on anarchist traditions as part of their distrust of centralized power, which appeared to them in the form of the state or the government. Their opposition to politics was based on a view that the process itself was rigged against the poor and the powerless. A second tenet of syndicalism is an emphasis on workers' power being located on the job. And in many ways, this follows from the first point. If indeed politics is a dead end, then the workplace is the route to empowerment. This commitment to struggling on the job is premised on a view of the economic system as being most vulnerable to attack when profits cease, that the collective withdrawal of labor remains labor's most effective weapon. It was this logic of disruption, of course, which fueled the Seattle general strike. The third and final piece of syndicalism is an emphasis on workers' control that has to be exercised collectively by the rank and file. This is rooted in a profound distrust of leadership, again, part of an anarchist tradition that has skepticism toward union leaders, political leaders, and the like. The workplace, in the traditional syndicalist conception, is conceived as a site where that could be a self-governing society in the future. Without the state, without a government, indeed without elected political leaders generally, workers weren't seen participating directly in their own collective self-government through their workplaces. And again, this vision was realized in the Seattle general strike to a very great degree when workers not only ran the city, but ensured that essential services were provided for its citizens. Each element of this European syndicalist tradition, the opposition to state and to politics, the building of workers' power on the job, and the pursuit of worker collective control, was present in the American labor movement as well through radical groups like the Industrial Workers of the World. While the Wobblies rejected the syndicalist label, saying that it conjured up foreign connotations and was associated with violence, they embraced a form of syndicalism in practice. First, like their European counterparts, the Wobblies rejected the state and political action more generally. Indeed, their opposition to politics is legendary. A delegate at the founding convention put it this way: "The ballot box is simply a capitalist concession," he said. "Dropping pieces of paper into a hole in a box never did achieve emancipation for the working class." And when the Socialist Party, also on the left but more committed to politics, asked for support from the IWW, they denounced them as the socialists because of their commitment to gradual political reform. Secondly, like the European syndicalists, the Wobblies were committed to worker power on the job. They championed militancy and direct action at the point of production. They refused to sign contracts, which they viewed as a truce in an ongoing class war, and instead insisted on preserving the right to strike when the conditions were most favorable to labor. And thirdly, like European syndicalists, the Wobblies were committed to collective workers' control. And the Seattle General Strike, where workers ran the city, was much of a model for this. In other contexts, the Wobblies exerted collective control over employment, challenging traditional managerial prerogatives, not only over hiring and firing, but even actually organizing the work process. Now, I want to push this argument one step further and suggest that this syndicalist orientation, which characterized groups like the IWW, also extended to groups that were the mainstream of the American labor movement, including the AFL. Like the IWW, the AFL distrusted the state and avoided politics. Gompers enunciated his position as nonpartisanship. He felt that politics was the wrong path to follow for working class empowerment, and felt that in any case it would be divisive of the rank and file. The AFL therefore rejected any enduring ties to political parties, very much different from the European model, where the mainstream of the labor movements were closely tied to political parties. Secondly, like the IWW, the AFL relied on workers' power on the job. They championed militant direct action and fought individual employers with a tenacity seldom equaled by their more radicalized European counterparts. And third, like the IWW, the AFL fought through aggressive forms of job control. They waged militant struggles to defend the job territory of their current members through restrictive membership rules and work practices. A best example of this might be the building trades, where unions were able to regulate the supply of labor through apprenticeship programs and elaborate formal work rules to protect the existing jobs of their current members. In short, the AFL and the IWW shared a common syndicalist commitment that was based on rejecting the state in politics, relying instead on workers' power on the job, and championing aggressive forms of job control. But while they shared a common syndicalist foundation in general, they also followed very different strategies for organizing workers. The AFL followed a strategy that might be termed business syndicalism, playing on the common term business unionism. This was the syndicalism of skilled workers. It rested on the disruptive power of skilled workers, who often occupied strategic locations in the production process, and who, because of their skill, were not easily replaced by strikebreakers during a walkout. They could simply withdraw their labor as skilled workers and bring the production process to an immediate halt. The AFL, therefore, was in a position to sign contracts and giving up the right to strike during the duration of the contract, knowing that at the expiration of the contract, they had the power to impose their will on employers. The IWW followed a very different strategy that might be called industrial syndicalism. This was the syndicalism of unskilled workers. It depended on disrupting work when conditions were most favorable to unions. Because most of the followers of the IWW were unskilled workers, they were more easily replaceable. Planned and previously announced strikes were doomed to fail. The greatest weapon was the element of surprise, the need to retain the strike, the right to strike, to act spontaneously when conditions were most favorable. In doing so, the IWW tried to build an inclusive membership that acted collectively and spontaneously when conditions were clearly most favorable to labor. So let me just recap the argument so far. I've tried to make two points. The first, that the Seattle General Strike was a product of a particular time and place. It grew out of favorable conditions, in particular, the post-war strike wave, the special character of the Seattle labor movement, its radicalism, its unity, and the Bolshevik Revolution, which created a spirit of insurrection in the air. Yet the strike tapped into and expressed a more enduring syndicalist tradition. Seattle's workers, after all, avoided politics. They did not seek legislative solutions to their problems. They did not seek to vote politicians in or out of office. They focused instead their efforts on the job by withdrawing their labor. And they exercised workers' control, not just in shutting down the city, but in running the city and continuing to provide services for its residents. The second point I've tried to make is that the syndicalist impulse that animated the general strike in Seattle has defined the trajectory of labor in the earlier 20th century and beyond. Both the conservative AFL and the left-wing IWW rested on a similar syndicalist foundation. That is, both organizations rejected politics, focused on the job, and advocated for workers' control. But they did so, as we've seen, in very different ways. The strategy of business syndicalism pushed by the AFL that attracted mostly skilled workers versus the industrial syndicalism championed by the IWW that appealed mostly to the unskilled. In turn, this interpretation has several implications, I believe, for understanding not only labor's past, but its possible future. First, the battle between the AFL and the IWW was not about reform or revolution, as many people have thought, nor was it in any way a referendum on the conservatism or radicalism of the rank and file, as countless generations of scholars have argued. However much Big Bill Haywood and Sam Gompers may have disagreed ideologically about the desirability of capitalism, the rank and file were drawn to the kind of syndicalism that best fit their particular situation, whether it was the business syndicalism of skilled workers or the industrial syndicalism of the less skilled. Secondly, it follows that the AFL's victory over the IWW is not attributable to the presumed conservatism of American workers, their alleged love of capitalism, or lack of class consciousness, contrary again to generations of scholars and pundits alike. Rather, the AFL's victory was mostly a function of government repression of groups like the IWW, employer favoritism of more conservative groups like the AFL, and the long history of judicial hostility to labor in general, and particularly to radical elements within the labor movement. Thirdly, a concept like syndicalism, used as a framework for interpreting the American labor movement, allows us to make sense of its puzzling hybrid character that has baffled observers for decades. On the one hand, compared to organized labor in Europe and elsewhere, the American labor movement is politically weak and indifferent. On the other hand, compared to organized labor in Europe and elsewhere, American workers fight their employers with a level of militancy, violence, and determination second to none. In sum, what most observers see as the political failure of the American labor movement appears as less of a failure when it is seen as part of a syndicalist strategy that explicitly rejected politics in the state while waging bitter economic battles against their immediate employers. And fourth, this syndicalist culture, I would argue, has been quite resilient in the 90 years since the Seattle General Strike. The commitment to militant direct action enabled the organization of basic industry during the 1930s, led by the CIO. The routine militant clashes on the job during that decade, the major strikes in 1934 in San Francisco, in Minneapolis, in Toledo, the illegal factory occupations, the sit-down strikes that erupted in 1937, and continue to this day in the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago. Yeah. All of these, I would argue, are expressions of this underlying syndicalist commitment. Unlike the IWW, it is true, the CIO did sign contracts, but not in a way that extinguished shop floor militancy. In fact, there were contractually illegal wildcat strikes throughout the 50s, 60s, and early 70s that challenged traditional managerial rights in the workplace. And unlike the IWW, it is true, the CIO, and to some extent the AFL, participated in politics, but not as an end in itself and not as a means of seizing power. Politics was always about expanding worker power on the job so as to increase the organizing muscle of labor, just as it is today in the Employee Right to Choose Act, which is pending in Congress. So looking ahead, what do the next 90 years have in store for us? I believe that these syndicalist traditions provide a foundation for rebuilding the American labor movement. Not the only foundation, but clearly one. In manufacturing, where globalization and economic restructuring have taken a huge toll on organized labor, it's possible to imagine that globalization is something also of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, greater capital mobility clearly does limit the efficacy of local strikes. Employers can simply run away. On the other hand, global competition changes the production process in key ways that can also empower organized labor. Let me just give you two examples of this. One is the development of just-in-time inventories, which are used in many production arenas. This is a strategy of reducing warehouse costs by, in fact, reducing the size of the inventory in various factories. The second factor is increasing specialization of factories across the globe, which leads to their growing interdependency upon one another. The best example here is the global car, which is assembled literally from factories all over the globe. The result of this was evident a few years ago, when a small factory in rural Michigan, some 2,500 automobile workers, went on strike. In a few days, they brought General Motors, then the largest corporation in the world, to its knees. Why? Because there were no additional inventories around the globe, and because this particular factory was producing a vital component in transmissions that was used in almost every General Motors car. So here's a case where, counter to the dominant discussion about labor and globalization, we can see ways in which globalization might actually enhance labor's capacity to resist at the local level. Outside manufacturing, in the burgeoning service sector, workers also enjoy disruptive power to the extent that their services are both time-sensitive and spatially fixed, which is to say that their services need to be performed in one location. They can't be exported overseas. This is true, for example, of the transportation, sales, and recreation industries, where time truly is money, and where the timely withdrawal of labor can be wickedly effective. When buses and trains don't run on time, cities grind to a halt. When maids don't clean the rooms in hotels, when chefs don't prepare food in restaurants, and when clerks don't operate cash registers, business stops, and with it, the profits that are the lifeblood of the system. It is a reminder of that old syndicalist message that labor creates all wealth, and its ability to disrupt the flow of profits remains the foundation of its power. It was a lesson first learned 90 years ago by workers in the city of Seattle. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. You are listening to Labor Express, and I am your host for today, Dorian Brewer, filling in for Jerry Mead Lucero. Today we are focusing on the legacy and lessons of the 1919 Seattle workers' general strike that, while brief, in my view, is nonetheless under-recognized for its significance in the history of the U.S. labor movement, and as a fertile narrative for understanding how the general strike could be utilized again as an effective tool for struggling for the rights of working people again. We've heard a history of the 1919 Seattle General's workers' general strike and some analysis of the strike. Now we will hear from Rob Rosenthal, a professor at Wesleyan University, who in the late 70s did his master's about the strike and, very interestingly, also produced a rock album about it. Here he talks about his research and the music about the 1919 Seattle workers' general strike.
Jim's asked me to talk briefly about how it was that I came to write Seattle 1919 and record it, and what I think about music and social movements, which is something that I now don't do as much, but teach about and write about. So I wanted to tell you a little about how it came to be. I grew up in a home that was filled with music and with progressive politics. Those were two things always in my home, and so I think it was inevitable that at some point they came together. In the late 1970s, I found myself in Santa Barbara, California. I was going to graduate school there, and I was playing rock and roll in a garage band, which was a good combination. Sort of the two things seemed to balance each other out. I was studying political consciousness, that is, how people come to have the ideas that they have about their political world, about their social world. I was especially interested in how taking part in great events, strikes, rebellions, that sort of thing, how it affected people after the event was over. Did it change the way they thought about the world? And so I had become interested in the Seattle general strike because, as I think is clear from other things you've heard, I think that the Seattle general strike was the single most radical event in U.S. history. And I say that because there aren't that many general strikes in our history, very few, but there's only one in which workers went beyond a first step, first very difficult step, of shutting down an entire city, to a second step of taking over the city and running the city. And because it was such an amazing event, so radical, I thought that interviewing general strike participants and observers would help me understand how these great events affect political consciousness. But at the same time, I was very taken with the feeling of the strike itself. The more that I read about it, in the beginning I was just reading about it, the more I felt like the emotions of the strikers were very much like the emotions that I and other people who were had taken part in the great social movements of the 60s and the 70s, those were very similar emotions to me. And I felt the tug of those emotions and of what it is to be involved in an event that you think is maybe changing the world. And so I started writing songs about the strike, rock and roll songs, because I thought that the attitude of the strike, the audacity, the energy, the desire to change the world, that feeling seemed to me very similar to the feelings that I found in the rock and roll that I love best. That is, the rock and roll that seemed to be about changing the world in those days. And as I wrote more and more about the strike, I started thinking of it as not just a collection of songs, but instead as some sort of thing that went together, as an opera. Now, I want to be honest. On the one hand, I had a very conscious political strategy. I had a plan. I believe that the general strike contained not just an historical something or other, but lessons that were important for those of us at that time and in this time, for progressives and labor activists to think about. To think about what had happened and why it had happened. And yet I thought this history is almost completely unknown, even in Seattle. And I thought that by writing a rock opera and recording it, that maybe I could introduce this event and the ideas and the lessons of that event to people in a non-coercive way, in an entertaining way, and maybe people would think about some of these things. So that was my conscious plan, my political strategy. But once I began the process, it took on a life of its own. As I worked on my academic work, on a thesis about the strike, songs kept popping into my head, demanding to be written. You know, I would work until late at night in the university, and then I'd get on my bike and I'd ride home, and I'd get into this rhythmic writing, and you know, by the time I was home, there'd be a new song there because the combination of the two. But when I came to Seattle in the late 70s to start interviewing people who had been here during the strike, who had been participants in the strike, and to look at archival materials from the strike. Then the strike completely took over my musical life, and everything seemed to be material for the strike. So I can remember very well sitting in the archives in the basement of Suzalo Library at the UW, going through the Union Record, the labor paper of the time, and among other things, for the first time reading in its entirety, I had seen parts of it, but reading in its entirety, Anna Louise Strong's great editorial 2 days before the strike, No One Knows Where. Some of you are familiar with that. I see the nodding, but I'm going to, for those of you who are not, let me read you a couple paragraphs. Not the withdrawal of labor power, but the power of the workers to manage will win this strike. Labor will not only shut down the industries, but labor will reopen under the management of the appropriate trades such activities as are needed to preserve public health and public peace. If the strike continues, labor may feel led to avoid public suffering by reopening more and more activities under its own management. And that is why we say that we are starting on a road that leads no one knows where. And I read that, and I went home that afternoon, and I wrote a song called One Step Further, which describes that moment when Strong and other people in the city realized that this strike was something else, that it wasn't just enough to shut it down, they're going to have to open it up again. I don't care about the government. Think Rockefeller owns the president. Just a shuggin' for the millionaires. Just one way we're gonna get our share. That's right. Glory to Anna Louise Strong. I can remember interviewing a guy named Earl George, some of you may know. The Longshoremen's Hall, I think it was on Union Street down by the waterfront, and I was a pretty young man then, and I was overwhelmed with the history and the romance of it all. And there we were sitting in this ancient hall, and you could hear the seagulls and the foghorn coming through the windows, and he was telling me about being in the strike. And I said to him, "Did it change your life?" And he said, "It made me a class-conscious warrior." And I said to him, "Well, Mr. George, what was it like in Seattle when the strike started?" And he said, "Nothing moved but the tide." And the words were not even out of his mouth. And I thought, that's a song. And I went right home and I wrote that song.
I was born at Saddle Bainbridge. I grew up in the gold rush days. My daddy ran a tavern there up by Bristol Bay. And I heard the miners talking about a new world that was coming. And I believe I'd see that new world coming today. They said, "Boy, you listen closely. There's a secret that we know. They won't teach you this in schoolhouse. They won't tell you.
Over the next 5 years, I spent a lot of time with my friend and writing partner, Mike Rawson. We finished 40 songs about the strike. We eventually picked 21 that we thought told the story the best and rounded up a band. We spent 2 years recording, rehearsing, and recording the album. It's never made the charts, to say the least. But it's the corporate charts, yeah. but it's also, it's never gone away completely. Over the last two decades, I don't think there's ever been a time when more than a couple months have gone by without someone contacting me about the album or about the strike. And I take that not so much as a comment on the album as with a continuing fascination with this really unprecedented demonstration of solidarity and militancy and radicalism that once people hear about it, they want to hear more about it. I think music has a role to play, an important role to play in our struggles to change the world. Under the right circumstances, I think it can reach out and educate us about issues and struggles that we don't know anything about. Under the right circumstances, I think it can reach beyond education and help to bring us in to actually doing something about these issues and struggles. Under the right circumstances, I think it can help mobilize us, get us to do a little bit more than we would have done otherwise. Under almost any circumstances, I think it helps to play an important role for those who are already committed. It's a comfort in the hard times. It's a memory in the lean times. It's a celebration in the times of victory. It's not a magic bullet. Music can't substitute for the hard work of organizing, but it can be a part of that organizing. One of my favorite old folkies, Artie Traum, who died this past year, summed it up in the liner notes of an album that he released with his brother in the late 1960s. Music, he wrote, thrives on our energy, draws our hope, purges and soothes us. It is our life, but not our solution, a small part, perhaps. Thank you.
That's all for today's episode. I'd like to take a moment to thank Jerry Mead Lucero, host of Labor Express, for his years of countless week in and week out producing of Labor Express, covering issues critical to rank and file union members and working people everywhere. I'd also like to thank Wayne Heimbach for creating and producing the show for decades before Jerry. And also to Larry Duncan and everyone else at Committee for Labor Access and the many other volunteers for making Labor Express and this kind of people's media a resource available to all. Labor Express is a nonprofit affiliated with IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers and not necessarily those of IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Committee for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. The song we use for our theme is called The Worker's Song and is written by Ed Pickford and is recorded by the Dropkick Murphys. Tune in again next week for another edition of Labor Express.
Yeah, this one's for the workers who toil night and day, by hand and by brain, to earn your pay, who for centuries long past for no more than your bread, have bled for your countries and counted your dead. And the